This is The New Criterion. I'm James Panero, Executive Editor. This season at the magazine, we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of our Hilton Kramer Fellowship. The HK Fellowship honors the life and career of our founding editor, Hilton Kramer, by giving a recent college graduate the chance to join our editorial staff and apprentice as a cultural critic here for 1 year. We have now welcomed 10 fellows as colleagues at the publication, and I must say we are proud of the legacy they leave. Our fellows have gone on to appointments at the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, City Journal, and the American Spectator. Last but not least, several of them have joined our own ranks here as full-time editors. I note that our editorial staff is now made up of a majority of HK alumni. So this season, we thought we would celebrate this achievement with a series of podcasts with our fellows. For our first guest of this series, we didn't have to look far, as the managing editor of The New Criterion, Benjamin Riley, occupies the office next to mine and joins us here today. Ben, welcome.
Thank you, James.
Ben Riley was our 2015-16 fellow. Following his initial tour of duty at the publication, he went on to the Courtauld Institute of Art to pursue his MA. Here he wrote a dissertation on the masonry bridges of the Scottish architect Robert Adam before rejoining our editorial ranks. His research there has now been expanded and illustrated into a luxurious new book to be released by Triglyph Books this week called The Bridges of Robert Adam, A Fanciful and Picturesque Tour. Ben, congratulations on this publication.
Thanks so much, James.
You begin the preface to your book with the question, why bridges? Well, tell us first about Robert Adam and what drew you to his bridges.
Sure. So Robert Adam was one of the most important, if not the most important, British architect of the 18th century. He was born in Edinburgh in 1728. To an architectural family. His father was the most important Scottish architect of the previous generation. And Adam grew up in Enlightenment Edinburgh with the familiar figures we all know. David Hume was a family friend. And after a short time at the university, joined the family business, which was in architecture, but not only architecture. His father was the head of the Board of Ordnance, which was very important in Scotland after the Jacobite uprising of 1745. So Adam got a firsthand look at what it took to build not only buildings, but also fortifications and structures such as bridges. So that's Robert Adam. Why bridges? Well, they're sort of a between structure. They're not quite buildings, although they can have buildings on them. They're not quite works of pure engineering. They're architecture, but not really as we understand it today, especially now with modern bridge building techniques. So I was interested in looking at this, what I consider to be understudied aspect of a major architect's career. We've had lots of books on Robert Adam over the years, but no books on his bridges and only one or two scholarly articles.
You write that in 1754, Robert Adam made a French pit stop on the way to his Italian grand tour to the ruins of the Roman aqueduct, the Pont du Gard. How did these observations inform his architectural education?
He was keenly interested in Roman models, whether in Rome or in the provinces. He nicknamed himself Bob the Roman while on his grand tour. He was a little suspicious of Palladio, who was the 16th century Venetian, who had been the leading light for English and Scottish architects in the earlier part of the 18th century. Whether it was marketing or something else, he sought to attack that blackguard Palladio sword in hand. And in a way, he was looking for something pure, which was the Roman antecedent.
I see. So Palladio wasn't classical enough for him.
Well, that might have been the marketing spin. I think after Lord Burlington declared that Palladio was the only model, a way to stand out as an architect, as a burgeoning architect in a London scene that was crowded with imitators, was to say, actually, Palladio wasn't so good after all.
Your book includes some wonderful photography, and in addition to your writing, including illuminating overhead images that I assume were taken by drone.
They were, yeah. The photographer for all of the original photography, of which there's quite a bit in the book, was Dylan Thomas, not related to the Welsh poet, but one of the publishers of the book, actually, at Triglyph Books. And Dylan's a tremendously talented photographer who also knows his way around a drone. So yeah, weather allowing, we got the drone out in a few places and managed to get the overhead shots, which obviously they're very pretty and that's a purpose. But the larger, one of the larger themes of the book is that Robert Adam built bridges contextually. They were sort of meant to accord with the style of the house or the city that they were built in. The bridge is sort of uniquely situated to be able to do that. It's a connector. As a result, if you can get a shot with both the house and the bridge in it, it makes the point a lot clearer. And a lot of times drone is the only way.
Well, I have to say also those overhead images, they show that he was considering the grace of his bridges from three dimensions, not just from the side, but from the top down. Was he unusual in this way to not just have a bridge that you kind of plunk somewhere?
He was, there are sort of two aspects to his thinking about this. The first is his sense of the picturesque, which was ill-defined at the time, but comes to be a major topic in art and architecture in the latter part of the 18th century. So he wanted to consider the picturesque aspects. He wanted to make it look like a painting by Claude Lorrain. Simultaneously, he was considering this notion of stylistic context, and he was really, in general, it's not true in all the examples, but in general, he was against the style of bridge building that prevailed in the sort of middle of the 18th century, which was to build these classical showpieces that had very little to do with their surroundings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was bridge building as basically an architectural exercise, a Royal Academy drawing, rather than bridge building as a contextually specific engineering project.
He built 15, or he designed 15 bridges?
Well, he designed over 100, in fact.
You focus on 15.
Yeah, I think the book includes 13, maybe 15, whether you consider a viaduct a bridge, I do, but some people might not. But he was thinking about bridges a lot. One of his pastimes was drawing. Which is a good pastime for an architect. And he spent a lot of time sketching these architectural capriccios, these fantastic visions of the Italian Campagna. And there are a lot of bridges. The Soho Museum, which was exceedingly generous in photographic reproductions of his works, they actually hold 9,000 Adam drawings, the bulk of the surviving office collection. They've got at least 100 bridge drawings.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Did you have a favorite going into this, or did you change your mind?
I hadn't seen all of them before. Mm-hmm. before we did the original photography, which was in October of 2021. At that time, I'd say my favorite was probably the Pulteney Bridge in Bath, which is the only major public bridge in the book, the biggest. And I would say the strangest, because it really goes against not exactly Adam's philosophy of bridge building, but it goes against prevailing notions of how bridges were meant to be built that have continued to today. The Pulteney Bridge in Bath has shops built on either side of the roadway. this is very similar to the Rialto Bridge in Venice. It's similar to the Ponte Vecchio in Florence, similar to Old London Bridge. By the time Robert Adam was building bridges, it was thought that building shops on the side of bridges was outdated mm-hmm. because it blocked the view. And people thought that the view was the most important thing. Well, Adam agreed that the view was the most important thing, but he wanted to feature a different view, which was not that off the bridge, but through mm-hmm. the bridge to a new suburb he was intending to build at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
The suburb was never built. The bridge was deprived of its context, but as a monument today, it still looks really good.
Mm. You raise a point before where not all these bridges are on public land. Many of them you had to get permission to photograph and observe.
That's right. There was a long permissions process with various private owners, public owners. It won't surprise listeners of this podcast to learn that the private owners were much easier to deal with than the governmental entities in the UK.
I'm not surprised. Well, tell us about the ongoing legacy of Robert Adam in the UK and here in the US.
Robert Adam has gone in and out of fashion as an architectural designer continuously since his death in 1792. The 1920s in America saw a major Adam revival. Architects like John Russell Pope sort of playing with the monumental forms that Adam used in his domestic architecture. Adam interiors were very popular in the 1920s. He fell out again. I don't know that we're seeing a revival now, but plenty of books seem to be produced on him. And I think there's an interest.
Yeah, well, I mean, even the bridges on the Merritt Parkway kind of evoke a bit of what he was doing.
Yeah, the sort of domestic bridges that Robert Adam built were very much in the tradition of typical small bridges on estates in England and Scotland, and anything built in the 20s in America would have looked like that.
Yeah, well, and you make a point, domestic bridges. I mean, most bridges are big engineering billion-dollar entities that don't exactly have a domestic component. I mean, are people even thinking of domestic bridge building these days?
Only a select few, I would imagine.
I wonder if we could turn back to the Hilton Kramer Fellowship and now your own work as managing editor of New Criterion. Every month, we review numerous pitches and manuscripts, some on their way to publication in the New Criterion, others not. What do you think makes for a successful piece in our pages?
I think the thing that matters most is to have a voice. Some magazines are very concerned to make everything in the pages sound the same. A very famous magazine based in New York does that. We don't do that. We like our pieces to read as if they've been written by an author. The author has a point of view, and we don't want to smother that. So the first thing is it must have a point of view. It must express it clearly with some style. And then what I always think of is that we like pieces to be serious, but not self-serious.
I agree. And also to have been written for us. It's very clear when a piece is just a piece, and then there's clear when it's a New Criterion piece. It's clear right away.
That's right. I'm often asked, oh, is it hard to decide what goes in the magazine? I said, well, sometimes, but usually not.
And what advice would you offer for aspiring Hilton Kramer fellows?
I think the best piece of advice I could give is to write a lot, but don't necessarily send your writing out. Wait until you really think it can't be any better. There's sort of no use in sending out work that is going to not be up to the standards of where you're sending it.
Yeah, and read a lot, too. I can't count how many people come to New Criterion. They barely have looked at our website homepage.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. If you'd like to write for the magazine, you should know the magazine. We're not a receptacle.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to welcome Ben Riley, author, editor, colleague, and Hilton Kramer alumnus here today. Listeners, be sure to reserve your copy of The Bridges of Robert Adam out now from Triglyph Books. And of course, also look for Ben's work in the pages and on the pages of The New Criterion. I'm James Panero. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, James.